Welcome back to the Reconnected podcast. This season's all about connection. Connection with others, connection with something outside of yourself, and the connections we make within ourselves. So today we're going to be discussing the topic of connection with others in the context of the digital age and social media.
So my sister Alexis and I, we are within the age bracket of what's called geriatric millennials.
Oh my goodness.
Which basically means that we are the older group of millennials who experienced life with minimal digital technology growing up as a kid in the 80s and the 90s, and then with an immense amount of digital technology as we experience it today.
So wait, is that BDT and ADT, before digital technology and after digital technology?
There's a joke somewhere, I just can't get it.
Yeah, there's something in there. Go ahead, keep going. We'll find it later.
So what's the difference between our generation and Generation Z and all the generations after them, whatever names they come up with?
Yeah, there's a lot of names. There's a lot of letters. I get confused sometimes these days and thinking about where the cutoffs are. But back in the day, we had flip phones, whether we were just dialing and texting, even if we texted. Sometimes people had beepers, right? Just to get somebody's attention to say, hey, call me. Don't know why young people outside of medical profession needed those. But nowadays they have smartphones, which are basically mini laptops that every child and human that you see walking down the road typically will have in their hands. We had huge camcorders and clunky cameras. They have pocket-sized recording devices in their smartphones. We had large computers and televisions with huge backsides. I think it was just the projector in the back, but that always seemed like empty space that seemed useless.
Why was it so big in the back?
Huge. They have sleek smartphones and paper-thin televisions. We had tape cassettes, compact discs, mini discs, Walkmans, Discmans, that's a word I forgot in a previous episode, and even iPods. They have Spotify and Apple Music streaming services. We had disposable cameras that got developed at the local pharmacy or photo shop, and we had to wait a few days until we could see the photos that we took. Now kids have probably thousands or even millions of photos right on their phone accumulated over any given day, week, or year.
So we had a landline phone in our homes to call our friends to come over and hang out. We even had to risk the possibility of our friends' parents picking up the phone, right? We would call the landline and say, Mr. T, is Mark home? Can we play? Can we come over? And now kids have phones, but they're not actually phones. Like we said, they're actually laptops because nobody actually uses them as a real phone to pick up the phone and call somebody and vice versa as much as we used to back in the day. We used to have maps or MapQuest, which is basically a printout of the directions to go to figure out where we're going on the road trip. I used to deliver pizzas in high school. And I had a map, and I would even like call if I
needed. You would pull over to a payphone and call mom and ask.
Well, I did have a cell phone, but I didn't have obviously no GPS. There was nobody in my ear telling me like what turn to go. Nowadays, there is a GPS, and literally the voice just tells you where to go. What you don't think, you don't have to pay attention at all. Really, you just kind of listen and go. So very interesting. And when it comes to the internet and social media, we had dial-up modem to sign into America Online, which is basically a way to get messaging with friends or a web browser or chat room. You had to log in. So for those who are unaware what that means, the dial-up modem basically means that we were not always connected to the internet. We had to actually log into the internet. Whereas nowadays, when you have your smartphone, you're literally always connected to the internet. And it's really interesting, around 2000, 1999, I believe, the movie The Matrix came out, right around the time when we became more and more and more integrated in the internet being part of our lives. We were in high school at that time, and just funny how society just gradually crept into being constantly connected with the internet, with broadband internet service and cell phone internet service as well. And funny how the premise of that movie is about the natural consequences that may or may not occur if we continue to live within a virtual reality, which, many ways we are. Hopefully that doesn't become reality ourselves.
Justin, can we get the dial-up noise? So it's really interesting because now we have social media that's so prevalent that kids just have grown up with, right? And It begs the question, is social media virtual reality? It's not literally a virtual reality, but it's pretty close to it. And for us, social media is another reality that exists outside of the present moment. It's the first medium that we as a society have lived within, which we're not passive consumers of just the technology, we're active participants. So furthermore, it's always on. So think about, you know, even just kids going out and hanging out with friends and missing an opportunity because they weren't invited or they weren't available. You know, this is the same thing with social media. It's always going. There's always this fear of missing out on something that's happening or that you should know about or you should be exposed to.
Right. It's always running. It's always moving. It's always going on in the background, right? Yeah. And you got to imagine what that does to our brains when we feel like there's something else. There's another reality happening that's not right in front of us that we feel like we need to be a part of or we need to access all the time because we do have access to it all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's quite the conundrum. So I remember around 2015, which was around the time when the majority of youth began using social media. It was kind of this cutoff when I guess over 50% of youth and teens begin having a smartphone, and that has absolutely increased. Like I said before, now it's about 95% of teens have a smartphone, right? And that's never happened before in human society. So what actually happened at this time? Well, it turns out through the research that you can say, is this correlational? Is it causal? You know, that's up for debate. But you can see that the mental health issues of teens has gotten much, much worse since that cutoff, right? And interesting enough, and there's a book called The Anxious Generation, Dr. Jonathan Haidt, who is a psychologist, talks a lot about this, and he looks at the research. So the book talks about how, you know, the mental health of youth and teens in particular did not deteriorate the way we're seeing now when we were going through things like 9/11, the economic crisis of 2008. Mm. So if you look back on the research, you would think, well, if it is these catastrophic events that happen in our country, that you would think that that would be the cause of the deterioration of youth mental health. And in fact, there wasn't this spike in mental health issues for teens at that time. But when smartphones became extremely prominent in people's lives and youth's lives, that's actually when we began to see the mental health concerns rise significantly. So you got to look at that as a comparison, right? Because sometimes it's hard to do research to really know what is causing what. And sometimes it's more than just one thing, right? It's hard to say it's one thing that's causing mental health concerns for anybody. But certainly that is an interesting fact.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. And I know we'll talk about this some more later in the episode, but there's this idea of if you know about something, are you going to identify as a part of it? And there's this idea that, you know, on social media, there's a lot of people who are talking about mental health and being more proactive to help people to better understand themselves. So were kids talking about their mental health or were they using different forms of coping mechanisms, maybe outside of themselves, outside of just the technology, to be able to, you know, build resilient tendencies to get through these really difficult moments that we experience in our lives?
Definitely, right. And so I remember, you know, working with someone long, long time ago who I was like, you know, I think your smartphone has become a bit of a distraction in our session. Could you, you know, leave it out? And this is like about when smartphones just became a thing. And I was kind of experimenting with different ways of dealing with it. And it was funny the reaction the person had. She's like, well, like, what if there's an earthquake and I wouldn't know about it, right? And so like neither of us grew up in an area where there's no earthquakes. So like kind of, you know, obviously it's a biased sample, you know, working with anxious youth.
As of 2024, we've now experienced earthquakes here in Massachusetts and New Jersey.
Right.
Both the places that we've lived.
Right, right. But you can kind of see though, like, you know, the way that the internet feels, it's almost like a sense of comfort and anxiety at the same time that you can know everything. But, you know, knowing everything, as we'll get into in this episode, is not always an antidote for anxiety. Sometimes it could help and hurt at the same time. So, you know, just a window into, you know, we're going to try to open up a conversation about, you know, what is the experience of a teen using technology through, you know, the work we have with our clients and patients and through the research and so forth and just trends. You might be wondering, like, are we anti-technology? Absolutely not. You know, technology has done some remarkable things for the evolution of how society functions and what we're capable of in terms of there's been a lot of it's been a force for good, and it's also been, you know, a lot of downsides. There's pros and cons to everything. I think as a psychologist, my job is to help people to look at things from multiple perspectives and to say that both things could be true at the same time, right? It doesn't mean that everything is all good or all bad, and to be able to see the in-between, the gray area and the common ground that we can also have when there's kind of opposing views on things. So we're going to try to have a nuanced conversation about this, as we do with all topics. We believe it is contextual, it's nuanced, and we're going to try to get into that. Funny thing, I just asked the producer before we started this, can you make my voice sound like Perry, the owner of this studio? And it turns out that AI can actually do that, which is quite interesting. We're not going to get into that today necessarily, but you can imagine how significant things will become as technology even gets more further down the road.
Well, I think one of the things that's been a prevalent theme in my work these past few weeks actually comes from Macbeth. A student I work with was looking at a scene to analyze it. And part of it was thinking about the difference between wisdom and fear. And I think as we go through this episode, I want us to hold on to this idea of, are we using wisdom to guide our actions and behaviors, or are we using fear? And sometimes digital technology and access to so much information puts us in that conundrum of thinking about, well, what's guiding our actions, our emotions, and behaviors? And, you know, it all comes down, as I always say, to executive functions, right? Building the skills to be able to make these decisions. And young people don't necessarily have that capacity yet. So how do digital technologies, smartphones in particular, shape the way young people are developing their brains to make decisions about what is helpful and not helpful across different contexts to navigate through different situations? So we've got a lot of really interesting things to talk about today, all about how we connect with each other in this digital age. So here we go.
Let's do it.
So for those of you who follow us on social media, you probably know that a very long process has recently concluded. Myself and my co-author, Dr. Lisa Carey, have completed and published a book called Supporting Student Executive Functions, Insights and Strategies for Educators. Now, we started this book a while ago, and I was fortunate enough to integrate in a lot of quotes from the students I work with over the years. And there was one in particular on page 124, I'm going to quote it, that came from a sixth grade student that I was working with, who out of nowhere started to recognize how digital technology was impacting him. And just give me a second, because I think this is a good place for us to start today. And it starts around this whole idea. The category in the section of this book is talking about, how do we teach learners how to use technology instead of just giving it to them, right? Because I think we miss a really important opportunity to teach learners how to use technology to be a good and helpful tool versus just letting them kind of go off to the races and see what they figure out, because sometimes that's where we get in trouble. So here we go. So we were talking a little bit about the brain, and a sixth grade student learning about habit formation asked me, so if I do something consistently, it strengthens my brain, right? So if I play games online, it's strengthening my brain. He was right. It does. Right? But those neural connections will get strengthened the more he plays a game online and fills those dopamine receptors. This moment opened up an opportunity to talk about how his video gaming habit is changing his brain. We talked about the positive impacts of gaming, as well as how too much screen time or engaging in video games only as a form of entertainment can impact his brain in a not so helpful way. Some studies have shown that too much gaming and screen time can impact sleep, mental health, and expectations outside of the digital environment. Opportunities can be missed to practice in the real world some of the skills that are getting reinforced in the digital world. So after watching a short video discussing what we were talking about and some of his reflections from the video, the student said, so I think I want to only play games online for maybe 20 minutes each day. What about educational videos and apps? This was another great curiosity that led to a discussion about how screens can be impactful no matter what you're doing, but that, you know, educational videos, typing practice, and other tools can be helpful to practice in moderation while being mindful of having too much screen time. And I swear, this is exactly the conversation we had and the things that he said, where he, without me saying, you shouldn't be on the screen so much, recognize like, oh, maybe this isn't actually so good for my brain as it's developing, which was amazing. So I captured that and put it in the book because people like to blame digital technology for us losing attention, not being able to focus, not being able to engage in things outside of digital technology. And from the introduction, we said, you know, we're not against technology. We just want people to use it well.
Intentionally.
Intentionally. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, totally. That's a great anecdote. You always have these great stories of like things that the kids that you work with say, and some of it's just brilliant.
I couldn't make it up. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you.
Well, no kidding about the screen time. I mean, you can think about sleep. What percentage of high schoolers do you think report poor sleep?
Oh my gosh, I want to say like 95%.
Well, yeah, close enough, 77%.
Yeah. At least 95% of those that I work with.
And if you go back to the sleep episode we had with Dr. Jade Wu in season 3, I mean, like, it's not good for your brain or your health. Like, there's a lot of negative consequences of sleep. And maybe, mm-hmm. you know, at the very least, we can all find common ground that screen time does impact sleep, and poor sleep is poor for your mental and physical well-being. So I think people who really are maybe even addicted to using technology, that we can at least find common ground. I think sometimes when there's differences and, you know, parents and kids are arguing about, you know, how much screen time, what should I be allowed to do, right? Sometimes, you know, my opinion working with families is you got to start with common ground, because if you don't start with that, you're kind of opposing each other, as in you're trying to convince the other person about who's right, who's wrong. And that usually is not the best way to resolve a conflict. So for me, you know, if you're a parent, you might want to think about, you know, start with common ground to see what you both believe in is true at the starting point.
Yeah, and understanding the motivations for using it. There's a lot of kids that feel very isolated from others, and they feel like, you know, whether they're gaming or connecting digitally and virtually with other people, that it feels like there's a social connection that's being met through those interactions. And we can't monitor or police screen time use until we really understand the motivation behind it, because we might actually be missing some really important pieces of what the young person is actually experiencing. And I would argue that it's the same for adults, right? Like when I feel the most disconnected, sometimes I go to social media to see what my friends and family are doing, right? And, you know, sometimes that's because my schedule doesn't always match up with theirs to have a conversation. So it's one way to make those connections. And, you know, we want to do some self-reflection for ourselves to assess, like, okay, what actually is the goal that this is serving for me? And help to young people to be able to do the same.
Definitely, yeah. And you know, people are different. For some people, you know, that quick connection you have with someone through social media, it might be fulfilling, it might be positive, but, you know, someone who really values deeper connection with people, you know, I'm certainly one of them, and I'd never used social media until, like, last summer, and it's been, I don't know, like 6 months, and I finally decided, like, you know, it's been productive with getting some creativity out there and having an outlet to, you know, showcase music and kind of have creative ways to do some stuff online, which I think creativity is definitely part of technology. You can use it as a platform. But certainly I think that, you know, for me at least, and certain people out there, when you feel like real connection and genuine connection and having organic interactions with people that feels authentic and it's in the moment, right? Like, I value that a lot. It's probably why I'm a psychologist, right? Because I do it every day, you know, in terms of working with patients in therapy. But, you know, for me, I reflected on what it felt like, and I was like a walking experiment, right? I literally have not used it until now. And I just checked in with how I'm feeling, and I'm like, you know, a couple things happened. One is it wasn't as fulfilling, right? I got to reach out to people maybe I wasn't able to connect with otherwise. You know, some people say, like, it's the only way I can connect with anyone, like you said.
Yeah.
But for me, it just didn't feel fulfilling enough. Like, it's like nobody has time to really engage in a more authentic, full way. So it didn't really do that for me. Another part that I will say real quick, and I'll give you the floor, is that I think it just pulled me away from being more more present. I think this is, to me, is one of the main things about social media. When you're always imagining like how the reality you're in, the reality that you're in could relate to a virtual reality. Like, well, how can we make this experience into a post? Or how can we present this on social media? Even if it's like a creative outlet and it's fun, it's like, you know, I did a lot of photography at the beach. I was like, oh, this would be a beautiful, beautiful thing to showcase and for people to maybe get some positive feelings out of seeing something beautiful. Like, and that was great, but it just, you know, there's a time, like it becomes almost like too consuming where you lose touch with just being present and just absorbing yourself in the moment because you're relating the present to the future. You're thinking, okay, how can I relate this in the future to something else on the virtual reality? And I really, you know, I started to really just not like that. You know, as much as, like I said, it's nice to showcase creativity and positive things out there. It just kind of pulled me away. And then you're kind of wondering, like, are people appreciating it? Is it something positive? Because I was hoping it was positive. People would benefit from, like, seeing something nice or beautiful or something like that. And then you're just wondering about it. And it's like, you know, it just pulls you away from being present and just experiencing the moment, which, you know, I feel like I've been a well-adjusted, you know, relatively happy person, like, without it. And I think it certainly just kind of pulls you away from being present. I think the more present you are, the more content you are in life.
Well, I think it's really tricky. There's a couple things that came up as you were sharing your sociological experiment that you've been doing with yourself. Because I think it's really interesting. Number one is there's a constant notification feed that happens, and a lot of people don't turn those off on their phone. I don't have notifications that really pop up on my phone on purpose because there's already like this thought. It's almost like this elusive wondering of like, well, what is happening? Yeah. Are people interacting with the thing that I shared?
Yeah.
Which is, it feels so foreign to me because I'm not very like other oriented. Like when I do and create things, it's because it feels like something I'm inspired
totally.
Or called to do.
Yeah.
Right? Versus like, how is somebody going to respond to this? How many likes will
right.
I get? What will
right.
they say? It's more of like, this is something I'm inspired to create and do, and I'm going to share it with the world if I choose to, or it's something that's going to be helpful for the people I work with. And I think when you pull it into a digital realm, you're literally like on stage and you have this audience that may or may not have bought tickets to your performance, but they're showing up
yeah.
or they might be like, you know, passively seeing something and, you know, maybe noticing, maybe understanding the intention. And you and I, especially, we're all about the nuance. We're not just about things on face value. So I think for both of us, I think we're saying the same thing that, you know, social media has kind of an inauthentic component to it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what you said before, a lot of people are thinking in a future orientation. And from my work, sometimes I wish people would think about their future selves.
More often, yeah.
More often, but not in terms of what other people are going to think, because that is something actually we can't control at all.
Right.
We can't control how somebody else is going to react or behave in the presence of something we do or say.
Totally, yeah.
But that tends to be the thought, like the example you gave.
Yeah, and like there's just so much content.
So much content.
You can't blame people for being in an inauthentic experience because like you can't expect anything from anyone.
Yeah.
And like, you know, for me, it's again, like I like genuine connection. I like really get, you know, diving in deep with people and connecting and conversing and talking and nuance. And there's just so much more stuff we can talk about that. But, you know, one of the things I remember when we were talking to Marissa about social media and how she, you know, she does a lot of stuff on there, I brought this up that, and you kind of alluded to this, it's kind of like you're becoming a famous person.
Mm. Right? Or you think you are, even if you're not.
Right. And not even that you think you are. There's just like the context of like when you're famous, everybody's watching you.
Mm.
That's all I mean by that. Not even if you want to be famous
mm-hmm.
or not. But
mm-hmm.
like you're literally just like people can see you all the time or
all
whatever
the,
you're doing.
Right.
And to me, like this is my biased opinion. But if you survey a lot of famous people, and you ask them, do you like being famous?
Mm.
If they were to be honest with themselves, they're going to say that there's a lot of downsides to being famous.
There's a lot of privilege, for sure, but there's most definitely a lot of downsides.
Right. Things that don't get discussed, things that we don't hear about because, you know, they may talk about it until they kind of have a breakdown or something, right? You see a lot of, like, these famous artists who, you know, they can't take it because of the stuff that they're going through. And now they're starting to talk more openly about that.
On social media, it's like all eyes are watching you all the time. And, you know, there's great benefit to that. There's a lot of people who have been able to share and express themselves in ways that they probably couldn't have otherwise.
So true.
Which is really
so
wonderful.
So true. That's a benefit, yeah.
Right? It gives even us a reach
Give you a
to
voice.
Be able to share information so far for free in this different platform.
Yeah.
Whether it's a podcast or, you know, on a social media site.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of detriment that potentially comes up to it. And I don't want to, like, paint it as positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
I just want us to think about this in terms of caution. So I'm going to press pause for 1 second because I want us to get into some of the data and the research. And Jerry's going to talk a lot about that. But before we do, I want everybody to press pause and actually check your phones and see how much time you have spent on social media this week. Right? Everybody has that access on your phone.
Mm.
If you have a digital smartphone, you'll be able to check in and see, okay, how much time have I been spending on these different social media apps across your week?
Mm.
Now I want you to think about other things that you would love to be doing rather than just being on social media. I do this weekly for myself. I do this with my students oftentimes. And without me saying how much time needs to be spent or should be spent or shouldn't be spent on social media, immediately, every time, like the anecdote I shared at the beginning from the book, the students recognize, whoa, that's a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
What did I actually gain from that? So I want us to think about that because in our work and in the podcast, we're constantly talking about how can we make minor adjustments in our lives.
Yeah.
To free up space and time, mental, physical, spiritual ability to be more present and to experience the purpose and joy of our lives. And I, you know, I want to just share that that is a point of focus that I think we need to pay better attention to so we don't lose track of hours, days, months, every single year, every single week. And you know, believe me, I do this check for myself every week because part of our work, part of our sharing the work that we do is through social media and it's consuming and it takes a lot of effort and time for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're grateful and feel privileged to be able to do that. But at the same time, we have to keep ourselves in check and create those small boundaries for ourselves. But Jared, you know, talk a little bit about, you mentioned Dr. Haight from NYU, his work and his book that's really caused a lot of waves in the past few weeks.
Mm.
Just to bring, again, to bring attention how much we are actively engaged in digital media.
Yeah. And to your point too, right? Like there's benefits and it's created access. There's so much learning. It's open learning. It's open helping each other, right? People can help each other more than they can ever have. People can share information more than they ever have. People could even make money, right? You look at athletes, college athletes now, they can make money through social media by advertising themselves. And like people need that, right? Especially you come from underprivileged communities, right? So there's definitely benefits, but there's going to be downsides that we're going to talk about as well. So to answer your question, Pew Research shows that in 2022, the amount of teens who report almost constantly are using the internet, right? So that's like the majority of your day, almost constantly.
Mm.
It's 46% of teens, okay? And that was 24% a decade ago, right? Roughly a decade ago. So it's just higher and higher. I can't get any higher. I mean, how much higher can it get, right? It's going to keep going higher. It's actually worse for black and Hispanic youth as well. The other thing you want to notice, and Dr. Haight points this out, and a lot of people point this out, is that teen girls have been affected the most.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there is a causal relationship between social media and mental health problems, that you can see that the rates of teen girls has gotten worse than for boys.
So yeah, for girls, depression has significantly increased over the past decade. In 10 years, from 2010 to 2020, there was an increase of 188%. 5% of ER visits for non-suicidal self-injury ER visits. That's an incredible increase over 10 years, right? And that's according to the CDC.
And it's also by the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, according to Dr. Heath's book.
So we want to really pay attention to what's happening. We don't want to just keep like putting Band-Aids on the problem and saying, oh, this stuff is showing up. We just need to treat the behaviors that are coming up. If you listen to the podcast, you know that Jerry and I are very much proactive, process-oriented to be able to get at the core of what's happening instead of just saying, oh, we'll just keep responding to the behaviors that keep presenting themselves. So we need to take like a deep dive and really think about, well, what is happening and causing these young people to be struggling so, so much? And when you look at the differences in what was happening in their lives, like we've been saying, social media activity, digital technology access has increased over this time period.
So let's get back into the kind of pros and cons of social media and the internet and so forth. So pro, let's talk about learning, right? If you're listening to this podcast, maybe you're trying to learn something, right? How amazing is that? You can just like learn so much. And, you know, the kids that you work with, the kids I work with, they talk about like, you know, it's great to have the internet. You can ask your friend for help much more easily in terms of learning something that you don't understand. You can look up videos and they're really kind of very helpful, right? Now, there's also like, there's different social media platforms out there or social media personalities out there that are providing a ton of information about health. Like, here's everything you can possibly know about, like, you know, nutrition, about the way your body works. And for me, like, so cool. Like, if you want to learn that, great. And if you have the capacity to learn at that deep level, great. I'm a little concerned, though, that it could become obsessive. Like, it's almost too much information for the brain to process, or I'll get into more detail about that, but I feel like it's just, it might be too much information. Like, if you know too much, sometimes it's overwhelming because you're like, where do I start? How do I put this into context? How do I apply this to me as an individual, right? Because the people consuming this aren't like talking to their doctor while they're consuming it. They're really just consuming it on their own or talking to other people who are in the same boat. So again, pros and cons. I think it's great that information out there, but I wonder, sometimes is it too much information? I've always had this idea, and Lex, this probably is inspired by you, that people need like graphic organizers on the computer or their phone to be able to say like, oh, this information fits into this category of how I'm learning something. Like, oh, and I'm going to put the video link here. Because otherwise, it's just all random information that you're trying to wrap your head around, all this random information. It's like, well, what's the context? How does it apply to me? How do I apply it effectively? Yeah. What's important? What's not important? Like,
Prioritizing information is really, really difficult. And there are apps for that, right? Where you can pull in different things into different categories if you choose to. But, you know, what you were saying reminded me of a quote that I've shared many times since this weekend already that mom said. She goes, how are kids actually navigating this world where they're just constantly bombarded by so much information and then they're asked to do other things and they need to shift? And they don't actually, because she's learned a lot about executive functions over the years, as you can imagine. She said, they don't actually have the capacity and the skills to do that yet. And I said, yeah, that's a huge issue. And it's a big deal, not only for adults in the kids' lives, but especially for the kids whose frontal lobes aren't developed enough to be able to prioritize and say, this is important. This applies to me. This doesn't. This is for right now. This is for later. And then to make those decisions. And to your point, it's really kind of challenging because a lot of the information that's going out there might seem like it makes sense and it might click with you because it might be something you're experiencing or a part of your experience that a lot of people gravitate to and say, oh, that's me. That must be me.
Right.
Or that's definitely true. And, you know, very few people will, and I'm guilty of this sometimes, I try my best to always quote and cite where information comes from, but, you know, it's difficult when you're putting out a lot of content to be able to, like, cite the exact study. There's a lot of really great people out there and influencers who do a good job of that, especially the neuroscientists that I follow. But it's a lot of these influencers who call themselves experts don't necessarily have the background and training. They might have just heard from somebody that this might be helpful, or they're working for a company that's trying to sell a product that might be related to something that may or may not be helpful. And for kids to just hear this and think that that's always the truth, or for adults to hear this and think because they saw it online, it must be true, is really difficult to be able to differentiate. Mm-hmm. So from a learning perspective, especially from, you know, an executive function perspective and a neuropsychological perspective, it's very difficult to differentiate between what is true and what is not true, especially in this environment.
Well, let me rephrase what you said. Maybe not differentiate what's true, not true, but to what extent, why, and how, and what context is something accurate or helpful, right?
Totally.
Because I think as human beings, we want certainty. We want to know, is this right, wrong, true, or false? Especially if you have anxiety, if you're a perfectionist, like you're more vulnerable to these things, right? So when you look at something and it's telling you, oh, this is what you need to know, and you're going to say, oh, that's always right, because it reassures you. People don't like ambiguity. And like, here's an example, right? Why does psychotherapy work? The best researchers in our field will admit we don't know exactly why psychotherapy works, but we have some pretty good ideas about how it could be helpful for a particular individual, right? And there's a whole, you know, slew of research and conversations and dialogue to try to parse that out and to say, here's some common factors that relate to all psychotherapies that you might be enacting, but also here's some specific factors that relate to specific types of therapy you might be using for a specific type of person who may need this specific type of therapy, right? So
I think the same is true for the medical field and also for teaching and learning. Like, we can approximate what might be helpful or needed, right, but it's really difficult to say every single time this is going to work.
Right. So here's the kicker, right? If someone hears me say this right now, and please don't misinterpret what I just said and be like, oh, psychotherapy doesn't work, right?
No, it absolutely does. But it's the answer that nobody likes. Like, everything's nuanced.
Exactly my point, right? So someone could literally just misinterpret what I just said, and I hope they don't. I hope they understand that there's nuance to it. And psychotherapy across the board, yes, there's proof that it is helpful for people, right? The question is why, how, when, in what context, and that there's nuance to it. And so be careful about social media, because as a human being, we have bias to want certainty, to want conclusions, right? To get to a conclusion. And that's why we were having a conversation with our friend the other day. He's like, you know, the people who work for me, they just want me to tell them what to do. Just tell me what to do. And to some degree, that's good. They're self-advocating for what they need. But on the other hand, it's kind of a reflection of what we're saying. People want answers. And a lot of times in life, it's more complicated than just black and white, all or nothing, right, wrong, that there's nuance to it. And so social media, I think, could prevent us. And this is kind of segueing into, you know, what I think is helpful for people to disengage from social media and to have real conversations that are organic, back and forth. Hey, let me hear your point. Let me make my point. Let's find common ground. Let's find differences. Let's figure out why we have these differences. Let's figure out the context in which we came to these conclusions. And let's work together to, you know, have an effective, productive conversation about something that may not be so simple.
I think there's a lot of caution around just sticking in a silo. And that's the trouble with social media, is that the algorithm will pick up on what you're paying attention to and give you more of it, which might reconfirm your original or initial thought, whether it's right or wrong, right? Whether it's accurate or not, whether it's helpful or not.
Totally.
And it's tricky, you know, even in real life, if you're only hanging out with people who reinforce your opinions or beliefs, you know, there's really great positive aspects of that, but there's also some caution, because when you're exposed to diversity, it makes it difficult to see different perspectives. And, you know, my co-author Lisa and I were interviewed on a podcast, and we were asked a question about, you know, why should schools and administrators care about executive function as an initiative to teach teachers about. And I said, you know, this is not even about just academics. This is about building a set of skills that allows for individuals to think critically about information that they're given, right? How can they look at different perspectives, zoom in and zoom out, be able to understand and parse apart different types of information, different people, different backgrounds, different experiences, to be able to arrive at their own decisions instead of just being passive consumers of information.
Which is hard to do. It takes time.
Very difficult.
We all need help to do that.
And it takes cognitive capacity and energy
and
to
support,
focus.
And support from other people and patience and compassion and understanding, right? All that stuff. And maybe, you know, maybe that's being lost in some ways. And by the way, like, the stuff that we're consuming, like you said, with the algorithm is basically like, you know, what's getting the biggest emotional reaction from people?
Mm.
And so what's getting the biggest emotional reaction from somebody is not necessarily going to give you, there's bias in that, right? Everybody's emotional reaction has some sort of bias to it. So we're basically being fed algorithms that are, you know, getting our emotional reaction. And those are the things that you're going to see more often because that's how the social media platform works. Things get catch fire, things get viral. Like maybe it's just because, you know, people like it genuinely, but a lot of times there's the emotional reaction that people are looking at it more often, and then it kind of spirals from there.
Well, I know not many people watch the news anymore, but if you were to watch the news, it's the same kind of effect, right? They'll put a lot of emphasis to prioritize one event or experience as if it's the thing that we need to pay attention to right now, as if it's the most important thing. They are literally captivating and saying this is the priority to pay attention to, right? And they have lots of different ways and techniques to be able to capture your attention, right? Whether it's visual, auditorial, or you'll hear people's tones of voice that this is the most important thing to pay attention to, right? But, you know, is that always the most important thing? And when most of the information that you're interacting with seems like it's the most important thing, how do you actually prioritize in your mind what's important for me? What's going to be helpful for me?
Right.
And for young people or vulnerable populations, that could be really challenging, difficult, and scary.
Well, it can also be crushing with anxiety. Right? Imagine that, like, you're learning about something like
climate change
is a great example, right? Because like people care about something that's important, and so if you can't contextualize what that means to you as a teenager, like, and this relates not just to climate change, it relates to a lot of things where you can feel immense responsibility for something as one individual and feel such guilt, anxiety, and suffering, and I've seen this with patients, because you can't put it into a larger context of, you know, how this relates to you in the broad scope of your entire life.
Mm.
And like everything right now that you're doing, every moment is going to make or break something, right? Mm. Or you're not doing enough. And the truth is, one person literally is not doing, nobody's doing enough, because it's impossible for one person to fix the problem by themselves, right? And that is a truth. It's a sad truth, right?
Because wisdom or fear.
We want to fix big problems.
Yeah.
But the thing is, one person, right, is not going to fix the entirety of the problem. And then, so if you can't wrap your head around that, right? Because kids are kids, right? And even adults have a hard time with this. You can feel soul-crushing guilt and pain that you can't fix it yourself, and like there's something you're not doing enough, and that could, you know, especially if you have anxiety, perfectionism, especially if you have other traumas and stuff that make you feel even more sense of guilt, they're going to be more vulnerable to something like that, right?
Well, I would say that, you know, social media has been very helpful, especially for young people who feel very passionate about a cause. So climate change is a good example where they can connect with others who are, you know, researching and learning and trying to be active for that cause. And it's brought a lot of people together because sometimes, you know, in a classroom, there's different goals. There's not always a lot of opportunity to talk to your peers and to hear what their interests are. So you might feel isolated in this experience. So social media has been great to be able to connect people in that way. You know, people who have an interest in health or wellness or psychology, you know, even just listening to a podcast and then being able to talk to somebody else about it can help to bring people together. And I think there's these really beautiful things that happen. And I've talked before on the podcast about a study that I was a part of back in my graduate work where we were using a digital technology to see how much more communicative will students with disabilities be if they have a digital platform to be able to organize their thoughts and plan what they're going to say before they share, in comparison to students who are just in class And the premise was, you know, if you're reading a piece of literature, how are you going to engage in a discussion about it? And we found that those students with disabilities especially were able to better communicate their ideas and engage in a discussion through this digital technology mm-hmm. versus outside of it, where they might have felt nerves or stress or anxiety, which impacts their executive functions to organize their thoughts, plan, prepare, and share. So there are some really beautiful benefits to be able to create access and create these connections that mm-hmm. might feel stifling or inaccessible in other venues.
Definitely. I love that. And it's so true, right? Access to communicate. That's pretty much the goal of what Universal Design for Learning that you advocate for, right? Is give mm-hmm. people different ways of expressing themselves and also different ways of engaging with learning, which mm-hmm. social media is doing both those things, you know,
totally.
in a pretty effective way. But there are downsides too. So I really want to get into like the relationship people have with each other. Because communication, you know, virtually is different than communication in person. And so I just want to go through some of these differences just to kind of like spark our awareness of, or just reminding ourselves that this is maybe happening. So when it comes to, in person, right, let's say that, we're kind of getting together and we're interacting with each other in some context. There's kind of like a chance to warm up to each other, mm. right? We're kind of like, most people experience this. You're like in a new setting. You kind of like feel each other out. You kind of like see what kind of mood they're in. You kind of like see what's kind of clicking with the conversation, what's not. There's like feedback. You can kind of pick up on each other and figure it out, right? Social media, you send, or any message you send to someone, you can send them like the nicest, most happiest message, and they could be having the worst time of their life in that moment that they receive it. And you would literally have no idea that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for someone who cares about connection, right? And you know, both of us do. It's definitely a downside, right? There's no synchronicity with each other because you can't synchronize with each other. You can't link up with each other in a way that's organic. And also, like, sometimes in person, you can kind of, you know, troubleshoot. You can say, oh, maybe I can find a different way of saying what I meant to say. Mm-hmm. Maybe I didn't want it to come across that way, and I'll make some adjustments. Social media, it's like, first of all, it's there in text. It's always going to be there.
Well, that's the thing. Well, that's the other thing that I don't think people really realize. If you write it, if you share it, if you post it, it's there in the cloud somewhere, whether you delete it or not. There's always going to be that digital footprint.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, you know, to my point is like, think about the opportunities that can happen in real life where you can troubleshoot. You can say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put it that way. That's not how I meant. Let's work this out. You can repair ruptures in relationships more organically, and you know, you can actually feel that the person means it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if
mm-hmm.
someone says sorry on a text message, you literally have no idea. Do they mean it? Do they not? Like what, like did they just say it to get it over with? Like nobody knows. Okay, so let's say that you have anxiety about communicating in person, right? Where, as I'm saying, like, you know, if you didn't have technology and you're able to converse in person, there's kind of more of this nuance in the dialogue, right? That could be very useful and helpful with the relationship and the communication. And let's say you're anxious to do that and you kind of, you know, you're using digital technology to communicate, right? Well, the less that you actually engage in person, in real time with the person, the more anxious you're going to be about doing it because you haven't done it, right? It's kind of like the skill erodes. The less you do something, the more that skill would erode, which is what exposure therapy is, right? I'm not saying exposure therapy is the right thing for everybody, right? That would be too broad of a statement, too much of a generalization, but certainly there are times when you help people to do things they're afraid of, which is exposure therapy. They learn that they can do it. It's not as bad as they had imagined or catastrophized in their mind, that the conclusions that they were jumping to are not as accurate as they thought because they actually did the thing they were afraid of, which, you know, there's a lot of effectiveness with that. I've seen, you know, tons of progress with patients who do that. And it's not the only answer. I want to be clear about that. But what I'm saying is that we have become so consumed with conversing digitally And to all the points we made earlier, a lot of the nuances can get lost that could actually be helpful for the communication and the quality of the relationship. Sometimes when you have a rapport with somebody, the relationship's actually stronger than it was before.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to things that we've talked about in previous episodes about being willing to make mistakes and then being able to backtrack and figure out how to gracefully accept that I made a mistake and share that with somebody else. Because just having that humility and showing respect for the other person, like, hey, I might have misrepresented or said something that might have hurt your feelings, and I want to make sure I address that. It does definitely strengthen a connection and relationship. And I think, going back to the pandemic that shall not be named, I think we all can think about the time where we had no choice but to live in a virtual reality. And I will speak from my own experience, and I know that there's some research that's starting to come up now talking about the reintegration into school, the reintegration into life, and how difficult the transition is for a lot of people, especially those from my work with learning disabilities or those who have mental health challenges or especially higher levels of anxiety, mm-hmm. that the reintegration into the physical reality, being able to converse, like you're saying, face-to-face, whether it is through a digital technology or assistive technology that helps you to have that there are different cues that we get from being in the same space as somebody else. And we also want to recognize that we realize that that's not always possible.
For sure.
And the beauty of digital technology is something that we benefit from. We have friends and family and colleagues all over the United States and all over the world that we're able to connect with through digital technology.
For sure.
But all we're saying is that we need to keep practicing these skills across contexts, right? To be able to integrate and really solidify these skills versus only being in one context. And I think if it wasn't just the digital environment, we'd probably be talking about something else because I think there's been a shift to being focused on one way of communicating and connecting rather than looking at the broader scope and landscape of what's possible. Mm. And from an executive function perspective, especially in a social emotional perspective, during the pandemic that shall not be named, sorry to bring it up again, but there was a lot lost. And I've said this many times that we lost understanding nonverbal cues where young people didn't have those interactions. They didn't have these natural consequences in an environment where they're butting up against things that don't work and then figuring out how to do things differently. Mm-hmm. We've lost a little bit of that cognitive flexibility because there is this heightened level of anxiety where we're worried about making a mistake or doing something wrong or what could possibly happen in the future versus where do I have agency to make change for the future and be able to progress, develop, and learn based on what our strengths are and the things that are not as strong. And this is, I think, essentially the message we're trying to convey here is that we can't get all consumed by one thing because it builds a lot of questions or what ifs.
So I think, to think of this more integratively, he would say, let's not just say virtual reality, virtual communication is all bad. But let's also not completely run away from real in-person communication and relationships. Mm. They're both important. Let's not kind of put this one against each other. That they're both. And by the way, isn't a hug nice sometimes? Don't we all need a hug sometimes? Physical contact is important for relationships.
Well, it's also important for mental health and physical health. I will find the study, but there's a study that shows, I think, an 8 or 10 or 12 second hug actually helps to increase at a certain level, an amount of time, a hug will increase your dopamine response and will help you to feel better. Right? It increases the sense of joy and safety.
Well, look, this is a broader point that I think we all seek comfort in life, right? And I'm afraid that the more immersed we get with virtual reality, the less comfort we're going to feel, genuine comfort. And to me, the best comfort you can ever feel is when you're with someone who really understands you, who's really present with you, who really you feel comfortable with. Like, to me, that is like the pinnacle of feeling comfort in life and in someone who's right there with you. And, I don't know if that can be recreated when you're messaging someone or when you're looking at someone's post.
I'm going to reframe that a little bit. There is great benefit to being in the presence of a supportive, positive, genuine person in your life who cares about the connection they have with you. And the digital interactions are often intentionally beneficial and might be helpful, but being in the physical presence of somebody who cares about you, who is genuinely there to connect, is probably one of the most powerful things that we have as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the question is, are we going to lose that more and more? And I hope that's not the case. I really do.
So I think, you know, there are a lot of people in the AI field and are probably going to push back on everything we say. And there's benefits to that, and we're going to explore that in future episodes too, because I think there are, again, pros and cons, benefits, and things that can be hindrances with any new technological innovation. And we talked about this with Will Daly on the episode too, that, you know, innovation and evolution is natural, and it's to be expected. Like, it's always going to evolve and change. But how do we continue to, you know, recalibrate ourselves within these new worlds, within these new technologies, to pay attention to what serves us well, what is going to be most beneficial for us across context and time, to really value relationships and connection, to really value the authenticity of being present in the physical space with another who's going to genuinely be curious and interact and challenging in a way that's going to continue to grow ourselves as individuals and the collective humanity. I think it's really important. And from a neuropsychological and cognitive perspective, I think it's really important for us to build these skills across context, not just in one environment alone. Every single interaction is an opportunity to potentially learn something, right? And it might not be learning information from the next best influencer. It might just be learning about pressing pause and understanding how information plays a role in your life and how that relates to what you care about, what you value, and how that helps you to grow your soul for yourself and for your connection with others. And to not always look at every image as, oh, maybe I should be like this. Maybe I need to do that. Maybe I need to go there. A good friend of mine said a really wise piece of information that, you know, we might have heard before. I have, but I hadn't heard in a while. She said, the grass is greener where you water it and where you strengthen it, where you choose to work on it, where you choose to pay attention. So I want us to just notice where our attention is going. And we're going to talk more about this on future episodes, but where our attention goes can often allow for where our neural connections grow. So as my student said, as we started the episode, maybe I should pay attention to how I'm using my time, the people and the connections that we're making, how they help us to develop as individuals who can figure out what our purpose is here on this earth. Because I think that is essentially the message, the exploration, and the journey that we're on here together.
Definitely. Love it. Well, great conversation. Geriatric millennial, Alexis. Geriatric millennial, Jerry.
I'm going to own it, right? I am a geriatric millennial. I have wisdom, and I am very mindful of any fear that comes from messaging that I get from external sources, digital or otherwise.
Do you remember the technical, real quick story, remember the technological advances of using the camcorder for a school project? Where I ate a fake cereal called Little Pennios.
Oh, that's the best.
And Little Penny, that was Penny Hardaway, my favorite basketball player back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And the camcorder videotaped me eating the box of cereal. And then what happened next?
And then all of a sudden you grew into somebody bigger and you were stronger because you ate the Little Pennios.
Yeah, and the way that worked was you just stopped recording. Someone else came in and started recording again. Nowadays, you can literally just like superimpose like Shaquille O'Neal and it like put your body into it. Like, yeah. God, it's just incredible.
Amazing.
Okay. Great conversation, Lex.
Yeah, thanks, Jer, as always.
Thanks for tuning in to the Read Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years. But it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at Reconnected Podcast. That's Reconnected Podcast, and Twitter at Reconnected. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.